Please.
Thank you. I'll start by thanking the organizers for this workshop. It has been an absolutely immersive experience, and I've enjoyed every moment of it. And I think the talk I'm going to give sort of touches on many of the themes that have been discussed in this workshop in the past 2 weeks. Sometimes tangentially, sometimes more intensely. I'm from the National Center for Biological Sciences, which is part of a larger institute called the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research, which is located in Bombay, but our campus is off in Bangalore, which is in the south of India. This is a picture of our building now from several years ago. My lab is somewhere there. Many things have changed. There's a large building that has come out in the back. That's what this building looks like at night. It's very nice. I invite you all to please come visit us. It's a wonderful place to hang out, great food, and so on. Now, my lab studies insect flight in the broadest sense of the term, and I am going to sort of quickly take you through some of the things and then really focus in on one little aspect that we've been working on. The focus has been, at least in the past 10 years or so, in trying to sort of look at behavior. So behavior is at the center of everything that we do. And behaviors are typically flight behaviors, but not always restricted to flight. And what I've done here is sort of put a skeletal framework of the nature of the problems that we study. So if one wants to kind of study behavior, you have to go out and look for the context in which this behavior has happened. So we, flight typically is occurring for finding mates, finding food, defending territories, long or short distance navigation. And we've been quite lucky where we live to see all aspects of these in abundance. So, we see a lot of insects, they are everywhere, and they're doing all these things. We even see migrating butterflies across the campus. It's really been quite nice, and we're studying all aspects of these questions. So once you've identified a behavior, the typical strategy in the lab has been to try and get this behavior into the lab and try and understand it, sort of assay it in the lab, and then try and understand what are the sensory parameters that affect this behavior. So what are the different sensory cues? How do they connect with the central nervous system at an anatomical level and also at a physiological level? And how does the CNS then process these cues into some kind of a motor pattern? And that's really what drives the many of the projects in the lab, a prominent one being trying to look at how antennae control flight, and specifically the mechanosensory aspect of antennae and vision control flight. What we end up here is with a set of motor neurons that are stimulating a concert of activity in the muscles, and those muscles will then interact with the exoskeleton of the insect, and they will generate forces. And this is sort of the biomechanical side of things, where the muscles or the motor code interacts with the exoskeleton, and then that leads to some very interesting biomechanics questions as well as physiological questions. And we've been working with that, especially looking at flies and how hot ears and wings are coordinated. And in recent years, we've been looking more at the mechanics of this problem. And this eventually will lead to the flapping of wings, which is then what we see as the wing motion. And then the wings will interact with the external fluid medium to generate locomotor forces. And this is what we eventually get as behavior. This is where I started many years ago when I was a PhD student in Mike Dickinson's lab. And I've essentially gotten interested in everything else in the meantime. So there's a lot of projects, lots of students. All the blue ones are current. All the light blue, light green ones are gone. to other labs, and the black ones are all PIs at various places. And I should also thank the various sources of funding. And there's many, many different questions going on in addition to flight. There's a question which relates quite closely to the talk you heard this morning on collective behaviors and termites and termite mounds. We have a moth biodiversity project, and I'm happy to talk to you about these if you're interested. We've been collecting moths and trying to catalog them, hawk moths especially. But I'm not going to talk about most of these things. I'm just going to talk about this one problem that we've been working on for the past decade or so. And even there, we've been looking at two systems, in hawk moths as well as in flies. And I'm only going to talk mostly about the flies, although the talk will begin with some of the old hawk moth work. So just to motivate the larger issues, I'm going to start with a video. This is that's interesting. I don't know why that's happening. There's a hawk moth that's coming in and feeding on lantana flowers. This is at normal speed. And what it's doing is inserting its proboscis into these flowers. And, you know, this is happens to be in a still environment. We're filming in IR, so, you know, it's so the moth is working in its natural environment, fairly low light level situations. Now, if you look at the same behavior, but you modify it slightly, this is a video from Tom Daniels' lab. You can see that as you move the flower, the moth is able to track the flower. A large component of this is, of course, visual, but also, as has been recently found out, a part of it is through the antennal, the proboscis mechanosensors. And the antennae are also involved in stabilization of flight, and something that we've been describing over the past decade and a half.
So how do you know that it's not stuck in there?
It's not stuck. Well, we that has been determined. Yeah, it's not stuck in there. But you know, if you had asked me a question some years ago and about whether or not the antenna or the proboscis is involved in this, I would have said unlikely. But, you know, very recently they've shown that indeed the proboscis mechanosensors are involved in this, in making sure that the proboscis is kept in there. So, you know, who knows?
But Sanjay, just to be clear, this is different from if the proboscis is out and if the flower is oscillating, you probably can't then shoot the target at that point. Like, this is once it's in, it's sort of...
Well, it would have to do some kind of tracking even then, even just to get the proboscis in. So, you know, there's certainly a large component of this which is visual. Now, what you saw was at normal speed. If you see the same thing now, but at under high speed case, and in this case, what the flower is doing is going back and forth. This is a film that was taken by Mike too. I don't know why this is, for historical reasons. Some malfunction. So you can see that the moth actually modulates its wing motion in a really interesting way. And you know, it's able to adjust to the changes in the flower motion, and, you know, essentially keep its head at some distance away from the flower. Flower doesn't collide with the head. So, what are the sensory cues involved? Well, we can think of the sensory cues at least as far as the flight question is concerned. From many different perspectives. One perspective is, you know, at what time scales is flight control occurring? And so this is within sort of the stabilization of flight requires a stroke-to-stroke or within-a-stroke feedback. And that comes typically from mechanosensors. And these include antennal mechanosensors. We've been looking at cephalic hair, stretch receptors in the wings, campaniform sensula, and in the case of flies, from halteres, and this is feedback that's coming in and constantly updating well within a wing stroke about the insect's stability during flight. Slightly slower than that, on the order of a few wing strokes, in flies especially, is the visual feedback, which comes from its compound eyes and ocelli, and we've heard a lot about compound eyes over the past couple of weeks. And then even slower than that, at more at a modulatory level, is the olfactory feedback that comes from antennae, maxillary parts, etc. And that is over multiple wing strokes. So that's going to kind of modulate where the animal goes over a longer time frame, but has very little to do with the flight stabilization within a fraction of a wing stroke. So why is odor tracking important? Well, it's many different contexts. One can think of flies or insects that require food and they are going to look for food using odor. They're looking for mates, oviposition sites, very important. Seen some of that also. And then if you're a mosquito, then you need hosts. So you need to find your hosts through olfactory means. Now, my talk uses the term strategy, you know, with some caution, but I want to bring that in and in the context of what a strategy is. And I'm thinking of strategy more as an algorithm. So the question is, why does it need an algorithm? Why can't it just follow the odor down to its source? Well, there are many problems with that. We've already heard about the fact that the odor is usually not, you know, spreading by diffusion, but by convection, and as often as turbulent plumes. And that, so there is inherent noise in the signal itself. And this means that just following a concentration gradient down to its source is not going to work, because the concentration gradient fluctuates over space. So you can see, you can sometimes get source concentration quite far from the odor source. It's not necessary that you can just follow the gradient down to its source. Then there are inherently noisy flow structures. I think that was clear in some of the previous talks as well. And the one thing that I'll try and give some sense of in the earlier part of the talk is that the flapping wings also disrupt information contained within the plumes, and insects have to deal with this, especially when the animal is flying, and also in some cases when it's walking, but it still moves its wings, such as in silk moths. So in general, plumes are kind of unreliable guides of the location or distance of the source. So, I mean, this is just a visualization of a plume from Mimi Cole's paper way back when. And you can see just how noisy it is, and the color coding is concentration. So you can see that the concentration is also all over the place and not necessarily indicative of how close you are to the odor source. So we got interested in this question several years ago now, but for a very different reason. This is back when I was still studying aerodynamic questions, and we had just sort of gone through a series of studies in which we were looking at flows around the flapping wings, and the next logical step but that question was to ask what was the flow like around the body of the insect. And so I set up an experiment with Nate Jacobson at Tom Daniels' lab to ask what is the flow like around the insect body. And so what we did was we tethered a hawk moth onto a tether post. There's a mirror here, a laser that goes across, and we detect how fast the laser moves or fluctuates. And there's just TV screen just to give the moth some motivation to fly. So there's a stripe going up and down, and the moth reacts to it. And what we are really trying to do is measure the flow in between the antennae. So that was sort of upwind to the wings, and then behind the wings, what I'll call the inflow and the outflow responses. We won't be concerned with this. This was more to do with the aerodynamic part of the study. Just look at this. And this flow is induced. So the wings, as you may be aware, there's a leading edge vortex that is small but stable. in flapping insects, and that causes, that induces a flow around the body. And that flow field is what I was really trying to model at the time. This is done typically using measurements. This is the latest kind of version of that measurement. This is called RoboFly. This was something that we developed during my PhD studies, along with Fritz Lehmann and Mike Dickinson. And so what it is essentially is just two wings that are flapping. There is a there's a hinge, there's a force sensor there, and so you can measure the forces. But the,
and there were bubbles to visualize.
Sorry?
There were bubbles.
Yeah, I should explain what it is. So this is a large model immersed in mineral oil, and it's filled with bubbles. And what you can do then is particle image velocimetry, such as what Jimmy described the other day. And you can see the vortices and measure the flows and model and then sort of correlate. And the idea there was then to ask how are the flows around the wings affecting the flow around the insect body. Now, I won't sort of go over the larger parts of the problem. There's one interesting observation that came out of that study, and that was the following. So if we measured the anemometer signal from here, let's just look at this particular one, the axial inflow. If one measured it, and you could see a steady offset of about 30 centimeters a second, that stayed not constant but kind of fluctuated a little bit, but over a long period of time you could see that there was this steady offset, and that meant that the insect was essentially pulling flow from the top, pushing it to the bottom, and it was enhancing the flow over its antennae. Yeah.
This is with passive diffusion of odor, right?
There is no odor here.
Okay.
Just flow.
Just
no odor. Yeah.
It's a hot wire anemometer.
It's a hot wire anemometer, and it's extraordinarily sensitive, which I described.
Why are you saying it's going this way? You talk the direction of the hot wire.
The hot wire anemometer.
I know how it works, but what the direction of the flow? Because it's not, it's why you putting the vector v. What define the direction?
So the vector here is defined more from model concerns. The measurement is what I want you to look at. Right. So we know that the flow is going from here to here. That's from various different. We measured the flow. There are many studies on how the flow moves. Yeah. Also through RoboFly, you can see that. So you have this offset, okay? And this is over a period of 180 seconds. The hot wire anemometer is an extraordinarily sensitive device, and so we thought of looking within a second. And what we saw was very interesting, which is that you see these individual peaks, and these are real. We went to extraordinary lengths to ensure that they are real. And if you count them, they are, about approximately 25 or 27, something like that, which is exactly the same as the wing beat frequency. And we know this because we are independently measuring the wing beat frequency using the signal from here, which I haven't shown. I got very interested in that, because what that meant was that the antenna was not experiencing a steady flow, but an unsteady one, something that was changing in time, and it was changing at wing beat frequency.
Just to be sure, induced, it implies that it's induced by the moth.
By the wings, yeah. Yes.
So what's the typical flight speed of a moth, though?
Typical flight speed of moth may be anywhere between 5-6 meters per second tops.
Right, so, if you're talking about steering, this is like a half of a percent effect, right?
Yeah, it could. So as the moth flies fast, this would be less and less important. You're right. The moth hovers a fair bit. And that's where it really becomes, that's the only flow it's seeing when the moth hovers.
I have a quick question. So is this because the antennas are moved coupled to the wing beats, or this is a consequence of the actual flapping of the wing?
So every time the wing flaps, it's pulling in air. Right?
This is a passive, it's not an active coupling, meaning that there is some sort of actuator coupling between motions of the wings and that of the antenna?
No.
Okay.
But this is not the motion of the antenna, this is just the
this
airflow.
Is just the airflow.
No, I was actually asking whether there was a motion of
the antenna also moves, but that's a separate story. Yeah, the antenna also moves, but that's a whole, and it's very small amplitude. So, so we got very interested, and when I wrote the paper out, I wondered aloud if this actually was of relevance to odor detection. You know, I didn't know at the time. I didn't even think I would be going in that direction. But some years later, Kevin Daly, in 2013, started looking at this question. And what he showed was something that I thought was very interesting, which is that the odor detection, this was now in Manduka, the previous study was also in Manduka, is optimized when odor stimuli are pulsed at a frequency matching the wing beat during flight. That was the title of his paper. And I'll just read out these two. So on separate days, odor was presented either continuously or as 20 hertz pulse trains to simulate wing beat effects. We varied pulse train duty cycle, olfactometer outflow velocity, pulsing method, and odor. Results of these studies established that detection was enhanced with odors were pulsed. We therefore postulate that olfactory system Mandibular Sextra may have evolved mechanisms to enhance odor detection during flight, where the effects of wing beating represent the norm. This system may even exploit the temporal structure in a manner similar to sniffing. So this was sort of where all of this evolved. And I got interested at the time because this clearly showed that the wing motion was somehow disturbing the flow around the body, into asking, you know, this is a problem then, because it is sort of mixing up flows in the front and then pulling them over the antennae. So this should, if anything, make it even more complicated for the insect to be able to detect where the odor source is based purely on an odor signal. It needs something more than just the odor signal to be able to detect the source of odor. So the olfactory resolution would be, you know, compromised. Okay, so now just a sort of quick primer on, you know, there's a wealth of studies in this field going back several decades. A person I collaborate with a lot is Mark Willis, and many years ago we did a series of experiments in his lab. So this is some data from that. Well, what we do is we put a pheromone source, not a female, I've just shown a female here, but a pheromone source upwind in a wind tunnel, and then you track the moth in three dimensions and see how the male moth then finds his way to the female. And these are typical of the tracks that you see. This has been observed, you know, for many, many years. And these tracks are often called cast and surge tracks. So casting is when it goes sort of normal to the flow, and then surging is when it goes parallel to the flow. But this strategy typically gets the moths to the female. And as you know, that odor plume is not this uniform plume, but it is kind of strandy, and it's got structure in it. And this is what these dates me a little bit as a videotape, but you can see that the moth is performing this cast and surge. So the idea is if they contact with the odor plume, then they go forward. If they lose contact, then they go sideways. And if they keep doing this, eventually they will get to the odor source. We also know that visual cues are important. Whenever we conduct these experiments, it's very important to keep the lights at some ambient level, even if it is low. Manduka operate in low light conditions, but you do need some light. And you know, you can actually manipulate the visual environment and fool the moth. So, for instance, if you move the stripes on the ground in the downwind direction, the moths will never reach the female. They'll just slow down before. And if you move the stripes upwind, it can cause the moths to go past the female. So this is something that we know. Vision is important. And we also know of studies that talk about optomotor and emotaxis. So you typically, moths fly upwind. How do they know that they're flying upwind? Well, one way that they know that they're flying upwind is also a mechanosensory cue, but is also through optomotor and emotaxis. So what if the ground moves from front to back, then you know that's fine, it's good, keep going in the upwind direction. But if the ground moves transversely, then what you do is you try and turn so as to minimize the ground slip until the ground moves from front to back, and then you're going upwind. And they use this strategy, then you know that allows them to visually go upwind. Yes.
Is there any evidence for path integration in moths?
For?
Path integration.
In moths, not that I know of.
I understand this gives you either upwind or downwind, but I don't understand how this strategy gives you upwind versus downwind.
It can go either upwind or downwind. That's right.
So how can it use mechanosensors to identify the wind direction?
So the antennae are also thought to detect airflow. So the antennae sort of get blown back a little bit. There is
Johnson. It's hanging in the air. What was the differential? If the moth is in the exosphere.
Yeah. So this is not clear. This has been a question. This is not clear. So the moth typically takes off when it's still on the ground, and it's it gets a whiff, and then you know the antennae come out, and then the antennae are thought at that point to detect airflow. It's not clear how, when it is in flight, it knows what the airflow is. But there's some ideas about that we can discuss later. So we got interested in this, and we decided to work on fruit flies, Drosophila. Some people call them vinegar flies. We use the term fruit flies for them. How do they find food? So, you know, we are especially interested in the multisensory aspect of this, asking how are the two inputs combining to allow the animal to make decisions. And you know, there's many other questions within this which we have not got to. I'm going to primarily talk about just the behavioral work that we've done. This is the head of the fly. The difference, the distance between the antennae is just 200 microns. So it's sampling a very small part of the space through this. And I just wanted to remind you that the antennae are also mechanosensors. They are not just olfactory sensors. They are as important in sensing mechanical stimuli, and they contain Johnson's organs, which are extremely sensitive. This paper claims that it's sensitive in the nanometer range, which is just extraordinary. But we've done intracellular recordings of Johnson's organs in moths, and you know they are extraordinarily sensitive. So this question, or a version of this question, was tackled by Mike Dickinson's lab several years ago. And what they did in that lab, so they had a circular arena. This was about a meter in diameter. And they have two cameras on top, and these cameras are keeping track of flies as they are doing their rounds within the arena. And we've seen some of this in one of the previous talks. There's these saccades that they have the straight line paths and saccades that they go through. And this is sort of what the apparatus looks like. And what they do is perform these experiments in two conditions. One is when they give no, there's no visual stimulus. I'm saying there's no visual stimulus, but that's not exactly true. There is visual stimulus that at the interface of this So there's black to white transition here. So there's some visual stimulus, but by and large, there's no pattern on the wall. So it's, let's just say it's, you know, it's depauperate of visual stimuli. And then another case in which they give a checkerboard pattern. And when they allow the fly to then try and see if it can localize an odor source in this, the odor source here is invisible. And it's shown here by a circle. And so what you have are the trajectories here and the heat map of several trajectories. And what you find is that, so in absence of odor source, the flies tend to have a particular region where they are most likely to be searching. And then when you give them an odor source, they very quickly hone in on it, provided there is visual texture on the walls. But if there's no visual texture on the walls, then they are not doing a very good job of it.
What's the size of the arena?
1 meter in diameter.
And the odor source, how are you?
So the odor source is on the ground, yeah. And the flies are hungry. So it was clear from these experiments that to arrive in the general area of the odor source, you need some background visual stimulus. And we got, yeah.
So in the first case, there is no odor, like the A and B?
Mm-hmm.
So the animal just doesn't explore?
Just tracking, yeah, just sort of searching.
But it doesn't go close to the wall. So even without the odor, the fact that you deprive from...
Correct. So there is, like I said, there is some...
If you put a source close to the wall, probably it will never find it. But if you put one in the center, it might do a better job, right?
Right. So it is, that's the reason it is off center, right? Is you want to be away from where it would naturally be searching in order to challenge it to actually look for the odor source. That's the reason to keep it off center. Yeah.
So is this a typical behavior that they avoid the periphery of the arena?
I don't know what typical behavior is. I mean, this is peculiar to this particular assay, obviously. I can't say what the typical behavior is. There may be behaviors where they might go to the walls for they need to land or something.
The looming stimuli that is promoted by the texture is a very strong signal to actually initiate a saccade behavior.
Saccade or landing. I mean, it depends whether you're going in that. So yeah.
A little bit of that can be factored in explaining why they don't actually get into the walls.
Are there always light on the walls?
Yeah. Backlit, yeah.
Yes. What's the time scale here and is the pattern static?
Time scale. If I remember correctly, the time scale is minutes. And the pattern is static, yes.
So how did you manage to have them fly and not walk?
In this? Yeah. This was done in Mike Dickinson's lab. They're hungry. And I'm sure there's a percentage of them that walk, but the ones they've analyzed, probably, yeah.
And there's no controlled airflow. They basically, the air is stick. You just only have an odor source.
That's right.
Air,
yeah.
But there's no. The air is stationary.
In this case, the air is stationary. At least there's no active convection. Okay, but we were interested in how do they, so this allows us to determine how they find sort of the general area in which the odor source is. But how do they pinpoint the food locations? That's where we sort of came in. When I say we, this is work primarily done by Nitesh Saxena and Dinesh, who has done much of the analytical side of things. And we decided also to work with Drosophila. And the initial steps, they're pretty easy. All one has to do is get some high-speed video cameras, put some flies in a box, give it some airflow. In this case, and you get two sets of 2D images, and then you can combine them to get a 3D trajectory. And that's a general, general method that we use. The box may change to a wind tunnel, as you will see in a bit. But otherwise the method is just this. So just quickly, what do we know from previous studies? Just kind of summarizing. I've already talked about the cast and surge. We know that wide field visual cues for navigation are important. We know that in certain cases like mosquitoes, even near field visual cues are important, and I'll be elaborating on this. And it's also important for airflow, and airflow is also important because, again, I'll show some of that. And plume tracking can only be carried out if there is airflow. Otherwise, there are no plumes, really. And then there's also this upwind odor-induced anemotaxis. And the main questions that we're going to ask are, what is the role of visual cues in all this? Role of odor cues and the role of airflow cues. So here's a simple experiment, the one that we really started with and what really kind of got us excited about this. This is just a platform with some bananas slopped on top. And we asked, let the fly do what it does. And here comes the fly. This is the part that really got me excited, which is that this was something that we consistently saw. The fly came in, it would hover, and then eventually land. And we started to wonder what was it doing? Why was it hovering? What was the strategy there?
It would be different if it was just like a non-odorous object?
It would be different. We have done experiments in which the object is not odorous, and it will either just not care about the object, as you'll see in a bit, or it lands on it, but it lands on it very steadily. So here's the fuzzy ball, which shows where the fly hovered. So we decided to take this further, and we constructed an experiment. So this is a wind tunnel. What we have are two cameras, a light source, flow that goes from front to back. There's an odor cue, combined with a visual landmark here. We release the flies at the other end, and the flies come in. And what we really care about, we may have trajectories for the whole area, but we really are looking at a space about 8 centimeters from the object, and this is the distance at which the object actually is visible to the fly as per calculations of its visual resolution.
So how far can they get the object?
So it depends on the size of the bead and what is the angle subtended on the retina. And so in this case, it's 8 centimeters. It's about 2 degrees is what we've gone.
But in this case, it's 10 centimeters.
Or 8 centimeters. Yeah. So the data I'll show you is all within, is what is happening in these 8 centimeters. And so we have 2 camera views, one from the top, two from the top, and then we can combine those to get a 3D flight trajectory. And then once you have a trajectory, then you can do a lot of interesting things with it. One is that you can sort of break it down into several parameters. This is the odor plume axis. What's the distance from the odor plume axis? The trajectory parameters. Surge distance, cast distance, etc., etc. So you can pull out all these parameters and ask specific questions about them. I should mention that this is a wind tunnel, and we were very keen that the odor plume not be turbulent. And so, otherwise you don't really know where it is. Oh, this is interesting. Okay, so this is just a supplementary video we prepared, which shows the characterization of the plume. So what? So this is a bead. What we are going to do is we filled it with incense. This just shows the process that we go through to quantify the plume parameter. So there's some initial sputtering of that thing, but then you can see that it is actually a pretty laminar. Then we enhance these images, background subtraction.
The Reynolds number of this
is on the order of, so the flow is about 0.1 meters per second. Given the size of the bead, it was between 10 and 50 or something like that. It's in the paper, I've calculated. And so what we do is we also change the environment around the bead, just to make sure that, you know, this doesn't affect the plume structure in any way, because these are the sorts of experiments that we are going to do.
Why does it have those two bands?
Which, these two bands?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is where sort of you're looking at a cone from the top. So there's a density increase, you know, where the plume is, because you're just seeing more smoke there. So this is just those images, and then we can quantify the plume width and as it some distance from the source. So let's start the experiments. The first experiment, of course, is you put a bead there, a black bead, no odor, and ask what do the flies do. As I mentioned, flies will fly upwind, but they don't particularly care about the odor, because, of course, if they stopped at every visual landmark on the way, they would never actually get to the tank. So you can see that they pretty much avoid this. Yeah.
What's the odor in this case?
Apple cider vinegar.
So the incense stick will have carbon nanoparticles, right, when you burn it. So it's going to be a different...
It would be slightly different, but, you know, it's not going to be very different. The Reynolds number is the same. The flow is not going to be that different. It's an illustrative example. Okay, now you pair it with odor. This is a sample trajectory. This is a problem, because, you know, it's showing, okay, so when I turn on the video, it's going to show the last one plot here, because there's some history. I'm not sure why that is happening. As you can see, it acts as a powerful attraction. And again, I'll show the, let's see if I can change the displays. Maybe this helps. Yeah, I think that solves the problem. Okay, so when the odor is paired, the visual object is paired with an odor, you know, then the flies will go there. And they do this even if the visual object is not a high contrast one, but a low contrast one. So the bead is not there, but it's just a glass capillary. Yeah, that solved the problem. So, in other words, the glass capillary is visible. It's not invisible to it, but it's a low-contrast visual source. Yes?
Wait, did you try blind flies at all to see if they could locate the object just based on the olfactory cues?
I didn't get...
Blind flies? Did you try blind flies?
Blind flies.
To locate the object based on just olfactory cues?
Blind flies don't fly.
Oh.
And that's the problem.
Okay.
They'll fly on a tether. They'll flap their wings on a tether, but they can't fly. So the some experiment.
That's true. Flies won't fly in the dark then.
They don't fly in the dark. Yeah.
But we can do the red lights, which is outside the separation. That's how people get away with that separation.
But they don't see red light either.
No, so.
So they're blind.
Yeah, but they can't fly. You know, with red light, they can't fly.
They cannot fly. If they don't see, they don't fly. That's been our observation consistently, and I think that's been other people's observations as well. So now let's look at some of the parameters, and you know, you start seeing interesting things. So you have three cases being compared here. You have a high contrast non-odorous object, and you can see that the average speed in general is quite high. Flies are not slowing down, they're not sampling anything, they're just flying past. Then you have the high contrast odorous object and the low contrast odorous object. They more or less lie on each other. They're not different, and you can see that in this plot as well. You have the non-odorous object in which the speed is significantly different from the other two, and the other two are same.
So this is in the landing phase, not in the approach.
This is in the last 8 centimeters.
Pretty much the landing phase.
Well, it's still quite far from the landing. So there's a lot of movement that happens. Fly is about 3 millimeters in size. This is 8.
But farther away, that's not
We went in with no expectations. We're just trying to describe what's going on.
Okay, so yeah? What's going on farther away?
So further away, because you know, past 8 centimeters, at least according to our calculations, they shouldn't be seeing the visual object. We don't particularly care what's going on. We are interested in where they are beginning to see the visual object and smell something, and how they are using these two cues. Okay, so the hover duration is also it's almost nothing. They don't hover at all when there's no odor, but the moment there is odor, then they begin to hover. And then the tortuosity is just sort of the actual distance divided by the straight line distance, and that's also much greater. So there's some indications that they may be sampling a lot more. So, you know, this was an interesting result for us. The fact that they seem to be slowing down, and we asked, well, where exactly are they slowing down relative to the the trajectory, and so on. So we started looking very closely at the trajectories. And this is a fly trajectory. The speed is encoded by the color here. In this case, this is from an experiment that will come later, but there are multiple objects. And what you see is that when the fly crosses the odor plume is when it slows down. Now, we've been careful to make sure that this was the first time, so because we know what the trajectory of the fly is even before, this is the first time that the fly has crossed the odor plume in all the cases where we're looking at this. And what you see is that there is a drop in speed when the fly crosses the odor plume. So that's where it appears to first kind of slow down, and then eventually will land. Yeah.
I'm sorry, what's happening in Z direction? Because, you know, the odor plume happens to be very narrow. So
that's right.
How in this case at all it will cross the plume?
Well, we are only talking of animals that have crossed that odor plume.
So what are the chances that they cross?
It's a cone, not a... It's not...
Yeah.
It looks like a...
Yeah, but
flash.
It's a tiny cone.
Yeah.
And he's saying he's taking...
All other who does for the cone just.
Yeah, so we are looking at those that are crossing the odor plume and asking what are these guys doing, and what you see is that when they cross the odor plume, there's a, and this plays out.
Again, isn't it just very clear? So you're saying when they cross the odor plume, because you also have the z-direction videos.
That's right.
Okay.
We have 3D plots. Yeah. And so this is a quantification of that. So zero is when they cross. Now, I have to say that, you know, we don't see the odor plume, right? We just sort of know where it is from our visualizations. There's that caveat. But we know we've identified a rough area where it is, and what we see is that when it crosses that rough area is where you see this kind of drop in speed. Much before that, there is no such drop. Much after that, there is no such drop. So there's a clear indication that, you know, the odor contact is causing this drop in velocity. So we then asked, okay, what if you took the odor plume and separated it from the visual source? So this is sort of the odor source. You pair it with a landmark source, so that's one condition. Then you separate the two. And you separate it by 1 or 2 or 5 centimeters. Okay, and ask, if you now decouple the high contrast object and the odor source, what will the fly do?
It's, you're running one fly at a time. You find it too long, then this spot is associated.
Naive flies. These are all naive flies.
But you mentioned that they just don't ignore the high contrast object because they don't smell.
So if they don't smell it, they ignore the high contrast object. But if they smell something, then they are attracted to it. So the question is, what are they doing? Are they following the odor plume down to its source, or are they looking for visual objects? And that was the thing that we wanted to find out. So I'll just show you 4 sample videos. So this is only odor, so the low contrast object, odor and vision. This you've already seen. And then here they are separated, and here they're separated by 5 centimeters. So bear with me as I show this video again. So that's one. Now the two are together. Now they're separated. And now they're separated more. So the plume would be somewhere there. So as you would expect, when this odor source is separated from the visual source, the visual landmark, by a large amount, it considerably increases the time that the fly needs to find the odor source. And that's what you see here. There's a significant difference between this condition and that condition. There's no significant difference between the speed, but the flight duration is longer and the tortuosity is a lot more. And the flies make mistakes. So when the odor and vision are separated by just 1 centimeter, there's a high likelihood that the flies will land incorrectly and actually land on the visual landmark rather than the odor source. Correct here means landing on the odor source.
First
landing, yeah. So that's the only thing we'll look at. This is when they're separated by 2 centimeters, now flies will make more correct decisions. And then when they're separated by 5, the flies have no problem correctly identifying where the odor source is. So what this suggests is that visual landmarks do distract flies from the task of looking for odor sources. And if that is the case, then one would expect that if you give it a clutter of visual objects, then this is going to cause problems to the flies. So then we had an experiment in which we have, this is the same as before, odor and one landmark, odor and a group of objects densely packed in 1 centimeter and then 3 centimeters. We couldn't do 5 because we ran out of wind tunnel. And we keep the odor a little off center so that if there is any centering behavior, which we know flies do have this centering response just like bees do, then that is not a contributing factor. So here are videos. This one you've seen already. Now, this is where they are. So the odor source is, I think, this one. Okay. Here it's the center, just three objects. So. And then here they are 3 centimeters apart. Again, this is the odor source. Okay. And so if we now look at all of the trajectories, then you can see that when they're densely packed, the flies make a lot of mistakes. The probability of landing is highest on the odor source, but it is quite high even on the other objects. As they're further apart, now the probability on this increases, but there is some small probability that they'll also land on the neighboring objects, and likewise here. And again, this has a cost to the fly in terms of the time it will take to find the food, the speed that it uses to get to its to the odor source, and also the time it takes to hover. So then we asked, okay, in all of these experiments, airflow was very important, yeah? And so we needed to kind of understand what happens in case of flies that are doing all of this in absence of airflow. Because the presence of air breaks symmetry as far as the fly is concerned. It has just one direction in which to go. And as you can see from the trajectories here, what we do here is just close off the sides of the wind tunnel. So it's a completely sealed off box, and then we do the same experiment. Now, I should say that when I say absence of airflow, as far as the fly is concerned, it's not complete absence, because like I showed you, the fly is generating flow around, little micro flow around itself, and so it is going to affect the fly's some aspects of the flow. But there's not going to be a very clear sort of lack of symmetry as far as the larger odor parameters go. So here comes the fly. Eventually finds the source. Interestingly, flies in airflow are slower than flies in absence of airflow, still air. They seem to be getting to the object faster, and they don't seem to hover as much as those in the airflow.
What's the average time to find the source, where if you just found this 10 centimeter with or without airflow?
I think the average times were not very different.
Yeah, I think the point was that you could sort of get this by just random.
Yeah.
Looks like.
When you say speed, is that ground speed or air speed?
Ground speed.
So if it's a 10 centimeter per second flow away from the odor source, wouldn't it? Could that account for the ground speed difference?
It's possible. I have to think about this. I'll get back to you about this.
So in this still air situation, so there's a diffusion of the smell away from the source.
Right.
So over time, concentration should be more or less uniform?
Over time, yes.
So I guess the key issue here is that initial oxygen, there's some kind of...
So we had heard from experiments in moths, I'm not sure if they're published or not, but we had heard that the moths are unable to do a very good job of finding the odor sources when there is no airflow. So they really need airflow. We don't seem to see that. And this may be just, you know, differences in the natural history of these two animals. Moths tend to be out there, Drosophila tend to be...
flies in a constant cold environment, which is not what the moth is
doing. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I don't know about constant, but yeah, very different.
Constant,
yeah.
As constant as it can be.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
Okay. So that plot on the bottom, did you do that the same thing without odor? Is there also a difference between the hover duration in airflow versus still air?
So without odor, they don't land on the object. They'll just go past it.
So what if you... I mean, it would be interesting to have a thing that attract them to go and land.
Yeah, so we...
If it's a problem of the fact that it's harder to land when you have an airflow, that's why they hover rather than over because...
Yeah, so we've thought of that. Is, you know, could that account for that hovering phase? Is that they are just sort of fighting the, because they're slowing down, and at some point, we just focused right now on the results. We haven't quite passed out why it is hovering. Whether it is to just, sample, or one idea is that they are. What they are doing is smelling and seeing at the same time and trying to establish a coincidence. That would take time. Yeah.
Yeah, relating to what you were saying, there was this paper saying that when they hover, they create a vortex that volatilize typically taste ligands.
Oh, I see.
So they have these taste receptors on the wing margin.
Oh, that's an interesting.
Sugar or whatever.
Yeah.
How long were they hovering in the banana case? In the original video you showed with the banana.
I think there was something like 10 to 15 wing strokes. Each wing stroke is about 5 milliseconds.
Also not for very long.
Yeah. Fair bit. In fly world, that's a long time. Yeah.
This is going back to a few slides ago. You showed that they slow down when they cross the odor plume. It looked like they were maintaining a slow speed for quite a while after that.
Yeah. Exactly, in the trajectory I showed you.
Yeah.
Yes.
How long was that time? And when did they speed up again?
That time is variable. You know, it depends on when it lands. Because what we're looking at is, so it eventually will land. And one of our running hypotheses is that is the point where they begin to go from just flying forward to starting to look for objects. Right? And there might be a point there of a change in salience. Now that's not easy to test. But what is interesting here is the fact that we know that the fly, when it's flying towards an object, but there's no odor, will ignore this object. Whereas when it has smelt an odor, suddenly these objects are now attractive to it. Right? I'll come to that just in a bit.
They increase their speed again after a certain amount of time if the visual cues don't give them.
Sorry, I didn't.
Do you know, so once they decrease their speed, is there a certain amount of time after which they go back up to the baseline that they were at before the first hearing?
So typically where we've seen this happening is in the last 8 centimeters, after which they will land. They'll either end up landing or they'll keep searching until they find the odor source. But, it's not quite long after that they will continue to fly. The other interesting thing about the still airflow, still air experiments, is that there doesn't seem to be much problem with object separation. They still take more or less the same time to find it. There's just one place where we see some difference. But there's a distinct difference. So I want to just summarize. In absence of odors, the flies fly past the visual stimuli. They're not interested. When they smell something, now they are interested and they will seek the visual objects. If the odor object is separate from the visual objects, then the flies search between the two objects. It takes, this takes time and causes them to slow down. And this is apparent in, you know, the various parameters that one has looked at. Then if the odor objects are close to the visual objects, they may make mistakes. So they are certainly being paying attention to the visual cues. In a visual clutter, again, this landing accuracy is density dependent. This is something you would predict from that experiment. And they again approach low density visual clutter at slower speeds. And in absence of airflow, they seem to be tracking down odor objects. They still seem to be tracking down odor objects. We don't know what the mechanisms are. We think there must be some form of gradient tracking, but that gradient would not be would be disturbed by its own wing beats. And all of these experiments lead us to this kind of algorithmic structure. So you have star flies. If they sense airflow, that's plus. Then they take to upwind flight. If they encounter odor, then they decrease speed. And then if there is an odor contact, they cast. If they lost odor contact, then they cast. If not, they search. Then they search for visual landmarks. If the landmarks are detected, then they hover. Odor co-occurs with the visual landmark. This is a hypothesis. Then they land on the visual landmark. In the absence of airflow, there is some visually guided saccadic flight, such as what you saw in the first set of experiments from Michael Dickinson's lab. If there is an odor encounter, then they follow an odor concentration gradient. Again, this is a hypothesis that we need to test. They search for visual landmarks. If the visual landmarks are detected, they hover. And basically, the same thing happens. So this is, you know, where we are at the moment. But I want to leave you with some thoughts. One is that we've seen any number of trajectories. I'm just showing three examples of this, in which the flies, having crossed the odor plume, okay, having encountered it, will keep looking for visual landmarks, and many times, you know, even land on the wrong objects. What this suggests to us is that flies have some memory of an odor encounter. There must be some part of its brain that's holding on to the memory of an odor that it had encountered. And so that argues for a working memory. This is a point of some debate in the field, whether or not such a working memory needs to be invoked. And I think we are now, multiple groups are converging on this idea that yes, there must be some sort of a working memory. And we've been really fascinated by these particular instances, and we would like really to construct experiments around these phenomena, because that's where I think a lot of the interesting questions are, as to what part of the brain is involved in this, and you know, to what extent are the olfactory and the visual memories also combining. So I'll just stop here. This is the lab. You'll recognize Shivansh here. There's one person missing, Agnish, but it's a crowded lab, but we are a close-knit family. I want to thank the US Air Force, which has been a fantastic source of funding for me. They really supported us throughout, and a Ramanujan Fellowship, which I got from the Department of Science and Technology and NCBS for a number of, yes, and Stephen Fry also has been very useful to talk to. Thank you.
That's a very good clarification. The last part about the working memory, mm-hmm. is that's very clear in the fact that if you just give the visual landmarks without the olfactory, they fly past.
Exactly.
They only land in the visual only if they recently encountered it.
Exactly. Memory. So if they had forgotten,
yeah.
then they would have ignored this visual landmark.
Differently, you might think me as to what are the alternative explanations about working memory?
That's the thing. That's what we always. But there were papers that actually actively argued against it, or at least said that this was not required. No, this was not.
Exactly.
So that's why we are invoking it. Yeah.
Well, for instance, if you cross the odor, you slow down on the current moment, and if you slow down, your chance of perceiving a visual landmark as going slow increases, and therefore you go on the visual landmark first.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that you,
one possibility.
You know, you're too close to the object and it elicits a landing response. So, yeah.
The visual clutter stuff is kind of subtle, because like, if it's a single point and a single odor, maybe it associates the odor with the point. If it's, at some point you have enough points that it's no longer associating points with odors, it's associating more of a scene or a pattern, and it's using those as reference points to like localize itself.
Yeah, so here's what I really am interested by is the fact that up until I came to this meeting and heard Marcus's talk, I did not think of Drosophila as specialists. You know, I always thought of them as things that will go to anything that gives interesting odors, like the slop of banana, right? Looks like nothing, but flies find it nonetheless. So it's clear that a specific visual cue is not required. It's something. But it is something that is, of a reasonable contrast as compared to the environment. So, you know, they're probably, you know, trying to just combine what they see and what they smell and trying to ask, is it the same thing? And that's, you know, that's what we all do, I guess, to some extent.
Curious question. So in the case of similar to the fly, it's presented with competing landmarks, and you see that it sort of commits to one and then actually decides to go to another one. Do you see hovering? Is hovering predictive of where she decides to land, or you can actually have hovering happening around one landmark and then still go on to another one?
They hover at all landmarks.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
If you did an experiment where you slowly move the odor source in a kind of cluttered field, would you say that they would have no chance of finding it? It depends on how fast you move it.
That would be an interesting experiment to do. There's something that we've discussed at some point, is that what you need is a dynamically moving odor source. The reason we haven't actually gone ahead and done it is because we weren't able to think of situations in nature where this might be happening. I'm sure, I mean, the moving flower is a good example, but you know, for Drosophila, I wasn't sure. Something carries the fruit on its back and moves. I mean, it's largely looking at static objects in space. Yeah.
Did you think of any experimental setups where the visual cue is on the odor plume, but it's not the source of it? Like downwind, the odor source.
Yeah, we haven't done that. We've thought in terms of staggering the cues in the Z direction, so Y direction. We haven't done that. We started to do some pilot experiments on it. Right now the clutter is just in one dimension, but we want to increase the dimensionality of the clutter and ask, you know, how is it dealing with that? Yeah?
So one thought just like triggered. So when you said like olfactory working memory, could it be like visual working memory? Like if there suddenly the object disappears, do you expect the flies to go and land there or something?
Yeah, so visual working memory is pretty well established in flies. You know, there's a series of papers. Roland Strauss has worked on it, Mike Reiser as well, you know. So visual working memory is fairly well established. The olfactory working memory is still something that we need to...
So you would expect to it to go and land?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you again.
Thanks.